There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you?
He learned almost too late that man is a feeling creature, and because of it, the greatest in the universe. He learned too late for himself that men have to find their own way, to make their own mistakes. There can't be any gift of perfection from outside ourselves. And when men seek such perfection, they find only death, fire, loss, disillusionment, traffic accidents, the end of everything that's gone forward. Men have always sought an end to the toil and misery, but it can't be given. It has to be achieved. There is hope, but it has to come from inside, from man himself. And who is he, you might ask? None other than Max Mike Movies! Oh, and that was the cheapest opening I have ever committed to digital tape. You know what else is cheap? The subject of our current series, Be Like the Corman, Roger Corman himself. And nowhere was he cheaper than last week's movie, Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh boy.
This week, he has more money, a lot more money. So he made X, the man with X-ray eyes. But was that a good idea? I know one guy who's sure as heck fire gonna tell you, and that's our host, Max. What the hell am I looking at, Levine? Max, tell us what you see.
I see that I'm Heckfire Ramsey, detective.
Do you? What are you looking at? And don't let see it.
I'm looking at the pictures in my head.
That's what I'm afraid of. Put your sunglasses back on. Okay. And I am the nostril of fear. Mike, stop making metaphors loose. So,
you gotta trim that nostril hair of darkness there, nose boy.
It's creeping evil. So this X-ray eye thing that was sweeping the nation, was it more than just a passing fad or simply another in a long series of cheap 60s sci-fi movies made by Roger Corman? Well, only one way to find out, true believers, so don't touch that dial.
Touch it. I dare you.
From the depths of last episode, we asked you what adapted movie was better than its source material. Turns out there were a lot of examples, and you gave them all to us, like this. Vince, who had an observation regarding us wondering if Little Shop of Horrors was the first mix of horror and comedy, started out with, quote, "I am not sure the Abbott and Costello meet," insert monster name, "series can be considered horror comedies. They were much earlier," end quote. Yeah,
it's a good point, but I would argue those are straight up comedies. Nobody dies in those movies. Nobody is even seriously hurt, nor do we ever think anyone's genuinely in danger. They're comedies with a horror setting. I think it's a good example. I hadn't even thought of that, but I would argue those are not in the same category.
Well, it's about time for Max and Vince to get in that cage match we've all been waiting for the last 291 episodes. But yeah,
two penguins enter, one penguin leaves.
Well, speaking of that, he must have had to go off and wrestle walruses or whatever they do up in Canada. But when he came back, he continued, quote, "I think Jaws was much better as a movie than as a book. The book sort of drags and has a lot of extraneous elements. Blade Runner is only attached to the Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep story by a couple of thin strings. And while I liked the story, the movie is much more interesting to me. Stephen King's The Body was fine, but the movie worked much better than his short story, in my opinion. Some people mention The Exorcist or Rosemary's Baby as better than the books, but I read both before seeing the movies, and they were so close with so few changes that they were kind of a wash for me," end quote.
Wild!
Thanks, Wild. Vince. Back over to the Facebook, we have Tony Kellner, who starts off big with, quote, "Jaws," end quote. Thanks, Tony. Of course, you know, yeah. Aaron Perez hits us with, quote, "Lord of the Rings," end quote. I think we might have to have a little talk, Aaron.
Oh, dear. But, my goodness. Thanks. That's controversial.
Yeah, it can be, but I can also kind of see his point. But, because that involves, reading.
Yeah.
Nick Hoffman, with a little more to say, wrote, quote, "I will second Jaws. Read the book before the movie came out, and it bogged down at the end. Movie seemed to resolve that. Would also submit Captain Blood. The book was written by Raphael Sabatini. The movie just nails it," end quote. See, and I didn't even know Captain Blood was an adaptation, so thanks, Nick.
Now I remember that somebody, I didn't know that until somebody I showed the movie to said, "Oh yeah, I read the book." Like, book?
Yeah, does it involve crayons?
What is book? Show me
show
book.
Show me book, yes. Thank you, Kirok. Dan Schaefer said simply, quote, "Clue," end quote. I don't know, I was a little bored by that. Thanks, Dan.
You're fired. Next!
Tyler Stewart, in three separate responses, said, quote, Shrek, The Princess Bride, gasp, and arguably Dune 1 and 2, end quote. Oh. Elaborating on Princess Bride, he added, quote, Don't get me wrong, the book is wonderful, but Goldman was one of the finest screenwriters ever, and his adaptation of his own book, plus the perfect casting and production, and the direction, made for a greater work, end quote. Thanks, Tyler.
Interesting.
Interesting. I never read the book, but...
I suppose did. The book's very good.
If you want anybody to adapt your own book, it might as well be you.
Yeah.
Regan McStravick responded, quote, Hair, I worked on two different live productions of the show. The show is good. The film is better, end quote.
I think I agree with that. I've seen the show, and the movie has more of a plot.
Hair, better, longer, fuller. Thanks, Regan.
Don't hate Mike because he's beautiful. There are so many other reasons to hate him.
Gee, your hair smells terrific. Stephen Kellner wrote, quote, Star Wars, end quote. I don't think we can allow that as it's not an adaptation, even though he points out the novelization came out slightly before the film.
But it was a novelization of the script, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I'm gonna vote no on that. He then added, quote, hopscotch, end quote. Okay, thanks, Steve.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a book. I didn't read it, but I know it was a book. Tim Potter gave us, quote, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Gene Wilder as Wonka. Thank you.
Whoa.
Way better than the book. Reread the book a few years ago, and it was terrible. Also, any Stephen King movie is better than the book. That man just needs to learn when to stop writing, end quote. Ooh.
Oh,
I bet you're going to get a lot of comments about that last one. Hey, Pet Cemetery, anyone? Maximum Overdrive?
Yeah, Maximum Overdrive.
I'm going to scare the hell out of you. Thanks, Tim. Val Coons, who does something with podcasts, and I think is the CEO of Maison de Velour.
Yes, indeed.
Wrote, quote, Funny, I was going to say Star Wars 2, but I'm going to go with Andromeda Strain for just one reason. I love the book. I love the movie. The movie has one thing the book didn't have, a female on the research team. In view of Dan's answer, I'd say Pirates of the Caribbean. The movie is just a little more animated, end quote. And again, Star Wars is not an adaptation, but thanks for the rest.
Interesting thing about Pirates of the Caribbean, though. I wouldn't have thought of that, but sure.
Yeah, I mean, we're just short of adapting the toy you got in a breakfast cereal as being adaptations these days. But yeah.
Secret Decoder Ring, the movie!
I mean, really? It's good. We're right up there with Cat Litter, the motion picture. Trust me on that.
Yeah,
it's coming.
No, I believe it.
It's going to be clumped all together, but it's coming. Roland Hardy brings up one I'd never heard of. Quote, The Looming Tower, Hulu series. The book was very descriptive, but too wordy, too much information, end quote. Interesting. Thanks, Roland. Do you know that?
Yeah, no.
George Saulnier had a few. Quote, I got three for you. One, The Maltese Falcon. They cleaned the ending and got rid of Gutman's daughter's overdose scene. Two, Holiday, 1938. Really deepened Philip Barry's play and made it more fun and less mean.
Don't know that one.
Me either. Three, Tideland. It's a marvelous adaptation that gets the tone of the novel perfectly. However, the images are just more visceral on screen, end quote. Well, I always love to hear about new old stuff. Thanks, George.
Yeah, cool.
Charles Forsyth posted, quote, I've mentioned The Mist before. That's a clear example, as even the author of the short story, Stephen King, thought the movie was better. The Postman was a pretty good book with a really weak ending that turned into an okay movie with a pretty good ending. Arguably, the movie is more satisfying overall. The overrated novel American Psycho was torture porn masquerading as social commentary, and the film actually managed to wring some decent social satire out of it. I'd never heard of Guardians of the Galaxy prior to James Gunn making them into blockbuster franchises, and that's because the source material is, lame. If source material can be another movie or a TV show, then The Brady Bunch 1995 was much better than its source material, but usually the book was better, end quote. I'm going to have to fight you on The Brady Bunch because, I don't know, no reason at all. Lots of pork chops and applesauce, that's why.
Wow.
Lots of good stuff. Thanks, Charles. Adam Mark scribed, scrubbed. The following missive, quote, The Devil Wears Prada, 2006. In the book, the Miranda Priestly character is an acidic, irredeemable bitch, and Andy's narrative reads more like a tell-all about the fashion industry. Andy has no narrative arc or character development at all. I found her to be dull, whiny, and entitled. Blech! The film wisely rewrites Miranda to have a controlled and cool demeanor and is depicted as the unrivaled champion of her field. Meryl Streep's performance in this role is one of her top three ever, and that's saying something. The director also wisely removes Andy's narrator role and gives her a character arc of self-discovery and maturing into a true professional. I treasure this film. The book is a throwaway. End quote.
Interesting.
I admit I had a little fascination with Devil Wears Prada for reasons I don't know. But there you go. Thanks, Adam. Dave brought us, quote, "In principle, I like to read and imagine and am usually disappointed by the movie. It takes something away. But there are lots of examples that go the other way. The Godfather stands out as the films are brilliant, but the book was drivel. I was also disappointed by The Wizard of Oz when I read the book, but I don't think that's fair to the book since I was in my 30s when I discovered there were Oz books."
Really?
Wow. Okay.
That doesn't make sense. I thought I remember being at Dave's house and I thought he had a bunch of them.
Only when he was 30. Yeah. Often, however, there are books that I don't get but then enjoy the film. I could not make head nor tail out of Wolf Hall, but the TV series was great. Sure what to say about Gone with the Wind, given that it's controversial, but I think I would recommend the movie over the book. I also prefer Dickens on film over the text. The aesthetics come out in a way that is not always described in the text.
Pistols at dawn,
but
sir!
But that may be a failure of my own imagination. Woo, end quote. Phew. That might be a controversial opinion, especially about Dickens. But that's what we like here on this show. Thanks, Dave. Diggsy O'Brien.
I'll smack you with a plum pudding, sir.
A flaming one. Degsy O'Brien was next with, quote, "Ian Fleming's Goldfinger. The movie adaptation improved on the book in altering the eponymous villain scheme, removing the book's logistically impractical idea of stealing all the gold from Fort Knox and replacing it with the movie's idea of contaminating the Fort Knox gold with radiation, rendering it untouchable and making Goldfinger's own hoard more valuable. I've had the dubious pleasure of trying to get through a couple of Fleming's Bond novels. The film adaptations of any of them could be included in this list, as the films remove most of Fleming's rampant racism, misogyny, and homophobia." End quote. Wait.
They remove them? Well, how much do they like? They leave. Good Lord.
Yikes. Okay.
Yeah, well, no, I've read them too. I read a bunch of them, and he's not wrong.
Wow. Well, thanks, Degsy. Seth Jacobs wrote in to say, quote, "Jaws and the Godfather," end quote. Thanks, Seth. I love buddy movies.
Jaws and the Godfather. They're cops.
Of course. Lauren Buxbaum offered, quote, "The Princess Bride. I actually read the book after seeing the movie. The book is terrific, but the pictures in my head were not as enjoyable as the movie. As a result, I have seen the movie dozens of times and never reread the book. The other two that came to mind were Dogma and Life of Brian. However, a discussion of their source might cause controversy. Certainly the source is familiar to more people, has lasted longer, and has spawned more versions and sequels.
Let my people go!
A lot of people, however, are unaware that the source is a translation from the Hebrew and has a completely different ending." End quote.
Nice one, Doc. Very nice.
That was awesome. Thank you, Lauren.
Great.
And just in under the wire, Harry McCracken journalisted, and quote, "Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and the Wrong Box," end quote. Thanks, Harry. I don't know the Wrong Box.
The Wrong Box, I got to disagree with him on that. It's a Robert Louis Stevenson novel.
Oh.
They did a British comedy with, I think, a terrific cast, but the movie is incredibly scattershot.
Has it got Jim Boy in it?
Jim Boy? Oh, no, it does not have. And you left out his first name, which is R. Jim Ladd.
Sonny Me Ladd or whatever. Anyway. Thanks anyway, Harry. But wow, boy, that was a lot of answer. But not from you, Max. What's your favorite "it's better as a movie than a breakfast cereal" answer?
I can't tell you.
Yes, you can, and you will.
It's a secret.
No, it isn't. Just tell us.
I got to say, I agree with the people about Jaws. The book starts out strong, but the movie is, you know, such a revelation. It's so good.
Is that Peter Benchley?
It really is better. Yes, it is.
It is. Okay.
But that wasn't the one I had picked in my head. The one I picked was another Stephen King adaptation. That was The Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, yeah.
Which, well, the short story is really good. The movie is amazing. And I think it's, you know.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's not a question of a bad source creating a brilliant adaptation. It's more of just the book was good, the movie's better.
Well, and I think that the ones that stand out with King, especially like The Green Mile, Shawshank Redemption, Stand Carrie. By Me. Carrie, I never saw. Wait, Carrie? No, I never saw Carrie. Didn't they remake that also? I
think several times. Oh, don't bother.
It's The New Star Is Born. Yay.
Yeah, kind of.
Now with extra pig's blood. I think it's just one of those cases where they got lucky. Because I personally, I will say this about Stephen King. I've not read a lot of his books. I've read four. In those books, three things happen. One, some parts of it takes place in Maine. Two, some parts of the book take place in the 50s. And three, the hero breaks his leg.
Yeah, that this I have read a lot of Stephen King, and there is a game called Stephen King Bingo, and those are three of the categories. There are a bunch of others.
And what I've read, when he's long-winded, sure, he goes on a little bit longer, but I really like his characters, and I find the plots generally compelling. So I'm not in total agreement with Adam there, but that's okay.
Yeah.
We're not here about just us. That's why we like to talk to you. In my case,
we're here about me. Yeah, what about you? What's your favorite adaptation?
Guess. Superior? Come on, it's...
Nope. You gotta say it.
It's Blade Runner.
Of course it is.
I've read a number of Dick's short stories, and that one's technically a novella, I guess.
Mike, by the way, is 11 years old.
Philip K. Dick. And I gotta say, if there's one thing that Dick is not really good at writing, it's characters. Now, to be fair... You may argue that the characters in Blade Runner are not exactly the most compelling things in the world either, which is fair. I, however, adore that film if you watch the right version. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that it, with the right version, treats the audience as if it's got a brain. And it's so rare these days. It leaves you to figure things out, and it leaves you to impose your own opinions on it as part of the film. And I really like that. However, the other film, and I think you should have guessed this one first, Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS. With special appearance by Zangief's ass. Sorry, it's been a while.
That's only in the director's cut.
Yeah, well, that's still important. But that is all well and good. But what is better is an answer to this week's poll question. What non-actor's performance in a motion picture pleasantly surprised you? We're talking stuff like Norman Mailer in Wild 90, Truman Capote in Murder by Death, lawyer Melvin Belly in Star Trek's And the Children Shall Lead, or... More seriously, Barbara Streisand in What's Up, Doc? Or maybe even one of the actors in this week's movie. Let us know. Right now, we're going to let you know about trivia.
The facts.
X, the man with X-ray eyes. Budget, $300,000, which for the poor man was pretty big. Yeah. Take, wasn't able to find out, but... Yeah. They sold at least 53,000 tickets in France.
Oh, he's a genius in France.
Yeah, he's right up there with Jerry Lewis, but yeah.
Uh-huh.
So how do you film the effect of being able to see through a building? Simple. You film it while it's being constructed. Quick thinking, core man. I applaud that. I think that's awesome.
Why not?
How to make this film longer? Well, first, you can have a close-up of an eyeball that lasts a really long time with nothing but music playing, but you can also film a 5-minute monologue about the human senses that's so boring, the production company removes it from almost all the theatrical releases. That's okay, dear. They added it as a special feature to the Blu-ray release. So, yeah. I'm not entirely sure it wasn't in the version I watched either, but yeah. Ooh. Hey, did the twisty roads in the final chase scene with Ray Milland look familiar? Well, they'd be almost their own character in the 1971 Steven Spielberg vehicle, Duel.
Duel, I know it.
See what I did there? Steven Spielberg vehicle? Ha, ha, ha. Dead silence. There was going to be a remake of this movie made by none other than Tim Burton. Thankfully, what was likely to be a dark musical was shelved, and yes, I made the musical part up, but come on! To be fair, Corman himself considered making an update of this movie, or at least going back and fixing the special effects, which I'm sure we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
In Britain, at least, this was part of a double Corman bill alongside The Mask of the Red Death.
Ooh.
When shooting the surgery scenes, it was thought best to shoot the hands of someone with a bit more qualified, and so those are actual doctor's hands. Amazing!
Wow! Were there actual doctors attached to them?
I hope so. As you may have guessed, the trivia was thin this week.
Thin on the ground, okay.
Hey, did those two boobs that were giving Mr. Mentallo trouble look familiar? It's because they were. They were played by Corman Stable favorites Dick Miller and Jonathan Hayes, last heard from in last week's Little Shop of Horrors.
Mm-hmm.
No flower eating, though.
No flower eating and no plant feeding, either.
Yo, good. Why does the cinematography in this movie feel cut above the usual Corman fare? That's because a bigger budget allowed him to hire an Oscar-winning cinematographer, Floyd Crosby.
Oh.
Yeah.
So he had two Oscar winners in this movie.
Yeah. Corman was cheap. We all know that. And a lot of times he gets away with his little budget cuts. But it was pretty obvious he wasn't going to crash that expensive powder blue Lincoln. So when we see Ray Milland crawl from the wreckage, it's an entirely different car that he exits, and it's not even well hidden.
I wasn't sure. I don't know cars that well, but I'm like, that car looks very different.
I think it was a Chevy. It wasn't even a Ford product. So there you go. Yeah. Seems that star Ray Milland wasn't a fan of this movie, and when he and Rickles appeared together on an episode of The Tonight Show, he dismissed everything about it except Rickles' performance, which he said was brilliant. And we'll be getting back to Mr. Rickles and his performance. Oh, yes, we will, precious.
What?
But Max, okay. You got anything?
Ray Milland, it did win an Oscar for The Lost Weekend before this, so I don't know what he's doing here.
Money?
He's not a what money? This $300,000 even in 1963, that's no budget at all, practically.
He doesn't get all of that.
I'm assuming he got a lot of it.
I'm betting he didn't even make Vincent Price money off this one, but there you go. Remember, last $300,000 budget, Vincent Price got to take a third of it.
Oh, that's right.
Home in a bag, yeah.
Well, but, I think all I need to know now is the plot.
Well, then on to a story about a quack who's gone to the dogs.
There's that voice again.
Dr. Ray Milland. Okay, the character's name was James Xavier, and no, he did not lead a band of mutants.
Telling you, his middle name was Charles, and he shouldn't have been in a wheelchair.
Wasn't. He is a scientist obsessed with the fact that humans can only see a small portion of the spectrum. It eats away at him, and all those ultraviolet, infrared, X-ray, cosmic ray, gamma rays, and you can call me rays that humans simply cannot see. And if we could, well, then that would be something now, wouldn't it? He's come up with a serum that, when applied to the eyes, should allow visual perception to increase many hundreds of percents. Dr. Fairfax, played by Diana Van Der Vlis, who represents a foundation that's footing the good doctor's bills, comes by for a status report as those have been lacking lately. Dr. X decides to give her a demonstration. He applies the drops to the eyes of a monkey and proves that it gains the ability to see through a few sheets of cardboard. But then the monkey dies, seemingly from shock at something else it sees. While Dr. Fairfax is impressed, the board she represents isn't, so it cuts off Dr. X's funds. He has no choice but to experiment on himself. That too. And so he doses his own eyes and soon can see through things like a good pair of X-ray specs. Amazed at his newfound vision, he uses it in his own practice, seeing the misdiagnosis of his friend, Dr. Benson, and then tries to stop his early morning surgery on a small girl. In the end, he shoves Dr. Benson out of the way and saves the little girl. But it's thought he's going to lose his license anyway. His eye doctor decides to take matter into his own hands and sedate Dr. X, but as they struggle, Dr. Brandt falls out a window and dies. Dr. X will surely be blamed, even though it was an accident, there was a witness. So he does the only thing he can do. He flees to a carnival and sets himself up with Don Rickles, renames himself Mr. Mentallo, and becomes a mentalist. Soon, Crane, played by Rickles, realizes who this Mentallo really is and how he can make a buck off people's misery. But then Dr. Fairfax finds Dr. X and tries to bring him back to his senses. They flee, with Crane threatening to turn them in. Dr. X escapes in a big old Lincoln, being pursued by the police as his vision gets weirder and weirder. He crashes, finds his way into an old-fashioned revival tent where the sinners are singing hymns, and is finally confronted with the old Bible quote, "If your eye offends thee, pluck it out." And so he does, screams, and ends the movie.
The film.
I know.
That is what happens.
Yeah. To be fair, the encapsulation on certain pages that rhyme with IMDb was a good deal shorter, but it
didn't really tell you things like carnivals and Don Rickles, so, which I think are highly important.
I would like to point out, did you notice all of the many parallels, or were they accidental? Maybe, maybe not. First, we have this guy's a Dr. X, but really, he could be a professor, couldn't he? He always wears sunglasses, like Cyclops did, and he calls himself Dr. Mentallo, and Mentallo was an old X-Men villain. Coincidence?
Well, here's something interesting. I know you're doing this potentially partially as humor, but one of my notes, and this is going past the actors, well, I guess we'll come back to them, is that this felt to me a lot like an early 60s Marvel comic. This guy is basically a superhero, right?
He is. Seems like it's something out of Tales to Astonish or even like Vault of Horror or something.
Well, here's my parallel. Dr. X wants to see gamma rays, puts drops into his eyes, anti-glamour rays. I mean, yeah.
You didn't go up into falsetto on the anti-glamour rays.
Yeah, well, it's amazing what you can get inspired by coming home from this grocery store, but yeah. Honestly, I thought it felt, because there was a lot of that. I mean, the Hulk's, quite honestly, the origin of the Hulk is literally ripped off frame by frame from The Amazing Colossal Man. It's exactly the same.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
So, yeah, that era, for me, of Marvel, this is, and the idea with Marvel at the time was to bring actual humanity into their heroes, show them as conflicted, not necessarily, flawed human beings, which, quite honestly, fits the bill. Now, that being said, I don't know how far you can take the superpower of seeing through women's skirts, but, because that happens, but, yeah.
Hey, if you've read any Japanese comic books, you know that that is often the holy grail for certain characters in many, many stories.
Hapusai! Yeah. So, I think that's one of my observations, too, and I think it's actually very apt, humorous or not, that this is a very...
I don't think it's a coincidence. I think it's very comic booky, and especially very 60s comic booky.
But it's... Well, let's come back to this. Because we have to talk about the actors.
Oh, yeah.
Let's start at the top. I want to leave this. Okay. A certain person I want to leave to the last. I think you can guess who it is. But let's start with Dr. James himself, Ray Milland. Ray Milland generally gives me the impression that he thinks he's a better actor than he actually is.
Ray Milland always gave me the feeling that he should be a better actor than he actually is. He gives that impression like, oh, this guy's going to be really good. And then he's... Okay.
I mean, he's better than John Agar, but I don't think they're really outside the same corral.
he is not an A or even a B-lister, honestly. I don't know how he won the Oscar. I think it was more the material, but...
I got to say this, for Ray Milland, he's actually pretty toned down, which is good, because Ray Milland is usually very, like, I don't know, bellicose and seemingly full of himself, and here he's...
Yeah. Check him out with Rosie Greer and The Thing with Two Heads.
I mostly actually think of him from a Columbo episode, which is, I'm sure he would prefer. But
yeah,
I think he does a decent job in this. And it might again be a reflection of Corman's directing, because we've said in the past that regardless of the rest of the film, he tends to get at least decent performances out of people, sometimes surprisingly good performances. And the fact that he managed to calm down Ray Milland, I'll take that.
Yeah, that's no small accomplishment. That is true.
How about Diana Vandervliss?
She's blonde?
Yes.
She doesn't really get much to do. She's all right. She has nothing to do except basically she's a sort of love interest for Xavier.
Yeah.
Which is really kind of creepy because Ray Milland in this movie is literally twice her age.
Yeah.
And she was 28, he was 56.
Let's face it, there was more chemistry in the set.
Yeah, quite honestly, I thought there was more chemistry between Ray Milland and Harold Stone, who was Dr. Sam Brandt, which is, I assume he couldn't accept his passion, then that's why he threw him out the window.
Well, Harold Stone is one of those character actors who's been in everything. Was he in Godfather? I have this feeling he was.
I don't remember. He might have been.
But he's been in everything. And he's a good, solid character, and in this film, he gives a good, solid performance. I think he's totally fine.
the falling out the window part, I admit, didn't see it coming. So
no, I didn't. Yeah, there's probably a reason, because that was just kind of absurd.
I gotta go back to
wrestle, fling!
Yeah, make sure
it looks really like he throws himself out the window.
Make sure the windowsill is only a foot off the floor and the glass is as thin as possible, and we're, 20 stories up, but whatever. I want to go back to Diana real quick. The thing I did like about her character is that we have a woman scientist in here, and there's never any of that, well, you're pretty good scientist for a woman. She's in charge of, like, giving reports back, and she's giving her report to the board. And
she's responsible for millions of dollars.
She's just sort of treated like an equal, and it's a tiny thing in this film, but I appreciate that in 1963. Yeah. So, yeah. Harold Stonehenge.
She's the only other woman who, is based. She's the only woman who really gets a character and keeps most of her clothes on.
Yeah. I will say, though, that she's kind of Barbara Bainey.
Yeah, you know, a little bit.
She's beautiful because they told her so, though. Yeah. John Hoyt, who I recognized as being the original Doctor on Star Trek from the pilot, The Cage.
He's been in everything.
Everything.
He's been in, I think, 11 million movies.
Yeah. So he is one of those people, again, just like Harold Stone, you can count on him for a good, solid performance, and that's exactly what he does here. He's fine. Mm-hmm. And then there's a bunch of other people that are here.
Very small part.
But there is one person who does stand out, not only because of the "What the heck is he doing here?" status.
Yeah.
But I got to say his performance, and that's Don Rickles.
Yeah, Don Rickles is a surprise in this movie.
He really is, and we're not kidding. Like, we're smiling, but we're not kidding.
No, it is a surprise. I mean, sure, he has a few bits when he's funny, but that's in context. He's a carnival barker. And admittedly, initially, I'm waiting for him to call somebody a hockey puck because he's doing insult comedy, but he's doing it because that's what his character's doing. He's managing the crowd. Mm-hmm. But then he puts in this... He turns out that... what the hell's his character's name again?
Crane. What's the frequency, Kevin?
Yeah.
Sorry. God. That's a stretch and a deeper.
Yeah. As this sleazy, nasty, but kind of understandable bad guy.
Mm.
And he does it really well, and it's not something I would expect from Don Rickles at all, let alone in a Roger Corman movie.
Well, not only is there some subtlety to his character's performance, there's this sinister aspect that...
Ooh, very...
Quite honestly, I could be afraid of Don Rickles. Mm. Like, you sit there and think of him always, he's the monkey of the Rat Pack, you know, he's the jokester, the whatever, and it's like, I bet you if you had a Rat Pack movie where they all just got out of a fight and left the room and Don was left on his own and then came out a few minutes later laughing and had blood on his hands, you would run screaming from Don Rickles.
Don Rickles can be surprisingly menacing.
Yeah. I mean, he's not just a pretty face on McHale's Navy or whatever that was.
Yeah. And, you know, he was a regular in a lot of those Frankie and Annette beach blanket movies.
Yeah, I saw Don Rickles. Why would you choose Don Rickles of all people? But apparently Jim Gaffigan did a drama recently, so who knows?
Yeah.
But yeah, which is where I got the idea for my question this week.
Whee. Ah. Hmm.
So yeah, I surprised. Very, very surprised. Usual question, have you seen this before?
Actually I did. Many, many, many years ago. I think it was on one of those Creature Double features on a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
I did see when I was a kid. I remember I was channel flipping, so I'd watch some, I'd go away, I'd come back. As a kid, it didn't really hold my attention.
I can see that.
Hey, what about you? Have you ever seen it?
Nope.
Ah, this is a new one. Okay.
And we enter a kind of horror that, while it's not fully developed in this film, will become a thing, most notably championed by David Cronenberg, and that's body horror.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And
let's face it, it was a wise choice, because that stuff's icky. It's creepy. Mm. It gives a lot of people an instant visceral reaction, especially eye stuff. Eye stuff.
Yes, I was going to say, eye stuff freaks people out.
Yeah.
It just does. It's kind of a cheap shot. Because it's something, it's universal.
Mm-hmm.
When you mess with someone's eyes, you putting something in them or damaging them or anything, you can't help it. Everyone just goes, ugh.
Yeah, like that French movie with the cat. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, good. I don't think it was, and although it's Corman and it's easy to ascribe that, I don't think it was used as a cheap shot. I thought it was actually, in a way, very effective. And stuff with the eyes, there's also stuff later on where we have an operation. So the bit about the malpractice or the surgery going wrong is that there's this young girl who apparently has this condition as diagnosed by Dr. Benson or whatever his name was. And in comes Dr. X.
Who'll build a creature.
Yeah, who basically can see into her because he's got these drops in his eyes. Although I got to say, every time Ray Milland puts the drops in, he misses badly. Absolutely.
Yeah, not just himself. There's a sequence where he puts the eye drops in a monkey's nose. I mean, he gets he hits the monkey's face. I'll give him that.
Yeah.
But he doesn't know how to do eye drops. You can tell.
He takes a look because basically his funding's been cut off. They're like, look, we need you back at the hospital. So he goes, he takes a look at this young girl and is like, wow, the diagnosis is totally wrong. He's not even going to get close. Yeah. This girl's going to die. I can save her. And it was actually a really kind of interesting point. I've got this power, and I guess with it comes responsibility. I guess we're back at Marvel.
Yeah. It was a little more severe in the operating room than you said. He doesn't just shove the doctor out of the way. He stabs him in the hand with a scalpel so he can't continue.
Right.
That's a major thing.
Well, and if one wanted to be technically correct about this, they would all have to go out and scrub again because the operating field had been so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But this is something where there's an attempt to do something with this character who's made his eyes do weird things, and that he's like, look, I know what's going to happen, and I can't let you basically commit malpractice. And he puts his reputation on the line, and it's an interestingly deep point for what is easily considered a cheap horror movie, which I thought was cool, you know,
because interesting,
you don't usually do that. But and honestly, I'm sure all they did was they took a bunch of organs they bought at the supermarket and they superimpose them over what he's looking. But it's icky. It's creepy.
It is pretty gross.
And it gets past the MPAA because there's nothing technically shocking about something.
There's no blood.
You
don't actually see him cut it. Well, they cut away when you see the knife come in.
Yeah.
But you don't see the actual organs except through the filter.
And so, like, the horror, I mean, this is technically, I guess, more of a sci-fi film than a horror film. But the horror that's in it, I think it's feels like somebody who really understands the rules of what Hollywood will allow and what won't allow, and is dancing around them in a way very nimbly, which is surprising because it's a cheap science fiction film with Ray Milland in it and Don Rickles. So the parts where he's doing in the beginning of the film, where he's showing the effects of these eye drops and looking into people and stuff like that, I thought were cool. Sadly, you could see when the money starts running out.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, we're looking at a postcard, or we're
we're looking at a kaleidoscope, or they just stuck some, you know, optical filter over the camera.
Excuse me, that was Spectorama.
Oh, excuse me. Spectorama.
It said so at the end. Yeesh. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I gotta say, go ahead, please.
I do have to say, the opening where we see the gigantic eye, all I could think of was Lost in Space. I see some sort of gigantic eyeball monster. It's like, ew.
Yeah, I said it. The music was very creepy, but that still frame of the eyeball, it's just like, it's more of that Corman padding we've come to love and enjoy. Yeah.
What did you think about this? Oh, sorry, you were going to say something.
I was going to say it was a great print, which it always amazes me that there is a great print of films like this.
Yeah. Well,
you know, I suppose. But it's nice when you rent something, as opposed to last week where I rented this from a large fruit-named corporation and their print stunk. I rented it from the same location this week and it's like, wow, really nice color, very sharp. Anyway, what was your next point?
What did you think of the swinging scene part? I'm sorry, they step into a room and it's like, hello, did we mention it's the 60s?
My note was, I think the Batusi's about to break out.
Basically, to try to help him unwind, Dr. Fairfax, Diane, I keep thinking of him as Ray Milland. I can never think of him as James Xavier.
That's because Ray Milland only has one character.
Yeah, and he really, because also he only has one or two facial expressions. I literally think his face can't move that much. It just doesn't.
I'm glad but he doesn't smile, because I don't think I'm
ready for that. That would be wrong. I'm sorry. That would just look creepy. But she takes him to a party to unwind, and this is, I guess, what Roger Corman's idea of a swinging 60s party would be, because it's guys in suits and ties and women in dresses, all, I guess, dancing, technically.
It was the twist.
It was the twist.
Yeah, which was still known at that time.
And they're, partying down with martinis. Ooh, naughty. That they're making with hypodermic needles.
Martinis were a big thing in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
So I get
it. Yeah, I know.
But then he whips out his x-ray specs, TM, and can see through everyone's clothes. And
for a while, mostly what we get is what I call Quentin Tarantino vision.
Well, and then he does kind of smile and laugh, and it is really creepy.
It's incredibly creepy, especially when that strange woman comes over who, for some reason, is uncontrollably attracted to him.
Yeah.
She doesn't even have a name. She's literally blonde dancer.
Yeah.
At some of her some of the dialogue in this, I saw you across the room. I thought you looked urgent. I like men who look urgent.
Like he has to go to the bathroom?
What? What? Is that flirty? Is that supposed to be sexy? What?
Does it say make a run for the bathroom on my t-shirt? Is that urgent enough for you?
Watching Ray Milland try to do the twist is an experience in and of itself.
Yeah.
It's kind of like you get the feeling someone just dropped some hair down the back of his shirt.
Which, as we now know, is better as a movie than it is as a stage play. Yeah. Well, and this goes back to Ray Milland, who's probably got a sense of humor on the level of Genghis Khan. So, to put down Genghis Khan.
Hey, Genghi was a wacky dude when he wanted to be.
As we know, he was quite the man.
Indeed, my mother.
see our entire episode on The Conqueror, if you don't believe us. But
don't watch the movie.
Yeah, I got to say, one of the things that you don't have in this film, for the most part, but is effective, not the dancing, is the lack of makeup. Because for the most of the film, there is nothing to tell us visually outside of when we see through his eyes that he's been changed at all. And it's still very effective, I think. Mm. Some of the special effects work. Some of it, like you said, is just, hey, look, a prism. But I like the fact that later on, they start subtly adding to his eyes. And there's one set of... they're called scleral lenses. They cover the entire eye as opposed to just the iris. And they've basically made the veins in his eye look black. And that's when you first, it's kind of subtle. And it's like, oh, what's going on there? Something bad is happening. And then he gets these really cool black ones with gold irises. I really liked those.
Those looked really cool. And then at the end, they're full on all black.
Which I got to say is a much better idea than putting some sort of latex appliance over his face, which is what they normally would have done. Mm-hmm. And I thought they actually looked pretty cool. The black eye thing is neat. I mean, we see that tons of times. We're still seeing this in movies. So that part was effective. Again, he can see through. I do appreciate the idea that with a vision like that, driving would be problematic.
Impossible.
Well, and I
couldn't see most of the cars. But
no.
Yeah, but I do want to, getting back to the party and the nudity. Oh. This is sort of early, we have to say it, all respect to the core man, but he also made a lot of his money doing a lot of TNA movies.
Much later, but yeah.
Yeah, and you can kind of see where that's starting here, because... Now, he's very PG about what you can see. It's mostly people below the knees or their backs.
Right.
But the camera lingers quite a bit.
But, again, this feels to me like somebody who literally knows the exact inch he can go to, and he will go to the edge of that precipice and then jeté back to Coolsville before the MPAA comes in. And
I take issue with the Coolsville, but sure.
It's like there's got to be a chart somewhere that the MPAA put out saying you can show this, but not the top part of this, only the bottom part of that. And he literally had a checklist and said, I'm doing it all. So I don't know. I give another check mark to the core man for understanding the limitations that are placed upon him by an otherwise undeserving body of them. And I don't mean giant ants.
Make me a sergeant and charge the booze.
So then we get to this portion where he literally has got nowhere else to run and he runs to a carnival. What did you think of that plot twist? It's like, well, what else am I going to do but become a faith healer?
Or a mind... Well, he's a mind reader. Oh. He's a fake mind reader.
Right, mind reader,
The amazing Mentallo.
Yeah.
And I have to say, his x-ray vision becomes remarkably targeted at this point.
Yeah.
Because he's, like, carefully reading notes in people's pockets or their driver's licenses, which are probably upside down or backwards or whatever to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And... I kind of get it. It's like, okay, well, yeah. What else are you going to do with this power that no one is going to let you use?
Well, and this is
you have to you pretend it's a dodge. It makes it's like the old joke of real magicians hiding in plain sight as stage magicians.
Well, and we're right back to early '60s Marvel again, because like people like Peter Parker is like, I'm going to become a wrestler. You know, what can I do with this amazing power? I'm going to do something dumb with it.
Hulk ends up in the circus at one point.
Yeah. Probably more than once. I know. Wasn't he also a hitman for the mob at one point, Mr. Fix-It?
Back when he was Mr. Fit, Joe Fix, I think his name was, when he was the Gray Hulk.
Yeah. So
nerd alert.
But the thing to me is that this film never reads like it's for kids. It somehow takes something that really was for kids and runs with it in a way that I was not expecting. And I, well, that's obviously I'm kind of giving something away, but. If you look at things like, I'm going to run away to the circus, it's silly. And in this way, it was kind of surprising. Like, that's not what I thought you were going to do, but okay. And then you can kind of see it. It's like, well, I think you could probably come up with something better. But in the meantime, you're Ray Milland. It's not like you fit in anywhere else. I mean.
And it makes sense. Circus people or carnival people traditionally don't ask a lot of questions about your background.
Right.
And even... The touch that I thought was pretty good was even there he doesn't fit in. Even there, they think he's creepy. They think there's, you know, why he keeps himself apart. Why doesn't he sit with us? Why doesn't he eat with us?
Yeah. And meanwhile, he continues to put drops in his eyes. I don't know if this quote came to your mind, but it came to mine. He tampered in God's domain.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. Yep. Yeah.
Well, and then eventually he goes running off into duel. And I got to say, Corman, you can see, it's like he said, I am setting aside a giant chunk of money because I want a helicopter in my movie.
Yeah, I bet that's where a lot of the budget went.
Well, and you might say, well, why would you bother doing that? Why not just have a car chase? But it's like, it adds a level of surprise and... What's the word I want?
It's a lot more tense. There's a lot more tension to have being chased by something in the air. It's much harder to get away from.
Well, it brings value in a way to the picture because you're like, well, we have a helicopter and it wasn't a toy like you might have seen in films like, oh, Danger Death Ray or something like that. Special effects by Billy. The one problem I had was that when he crashes, suddenly the helicopter is gone for 5 minutes and he's got plenty of time to make his way into the sudden appearance of a revival tent.
Yeah, that I had a little bit of a problem with, by the way. Those revival tent, those tent revival religious meetings, those were a Southern thing. I don't think they had them out in Nevada.
Well, Max, he was in California, and it was Southern California, where they all speak with a drawl.
He was in Nevada when he ran because they had gone to they went to fleece the most dismal looking casino I've ever seen.
Let's face it, nobody believes that was Nevada.
No, there's no way that was Nevada. So but it was supposed to be.
They might have had tent revivals in California. I don't know for sure.
It's possible. It's possible.
Yeah.
I want to get back to the tent revival, but I don't want to skip over the Las Vegas sequence.
That somehow, casino with a K?
Yeah. It's like Casino, where apparently they've never heard of color.
Yeah.
Everything is just very drab. He somehow convinces Dr. Fairfax to run away with him, I guess, to Mexico or someplace to get away from the police.
Right.
Because, you know, not big surprise, Crane double-cross, or he wants to leave, and Crane starts saying, murderer, murderer, when they get to Vegas. Now, I remember thinking, okay, that's actually pretty smart.
Yeah.
If you want to make money, that's a good place to go if you have X-ray vision. Although, I don't get how he could tell when the slot machines were going to pay off.
Yeah, that one I didn't get either, and I was like,
because the wheels are semi-randomized, and he'd have to know a lot about the mechanism. The cards, that makes perfect sense.
Except, once he starts winning, he becomes a total jerk and basically dares the casino to take his money away.
Yeah, I was a little surprised by that. I understood it, depending on how much credit you want to give either the screenwriter or Corman, that happens to people. They get carried away at the tables. If they get on a winning streak, they think they become gods and they become jerks.
Yeah.
And he literally knew he couldn't lose.
Right.
This wasn't just luck. He's like, you're basically just handing me your money. But it is kind of out of left field.
Well, he's also not really good at it in a way, because there's one point where he tells everybody at the blackjack table, no, don't draw a card. His next card's a face card. It's like,
yeah, he gives it away really obviously. Also, they would probably not have wanted him playing. They don't like you playing with sunglasses, the cards. They call them cheaters.
Yeah. Well, lot of that's for poker, but...
Yeah. Yeah, that was sort of... And then also, what a sanitized view of the casinos, because when they think he's cheating... Like, I just want to make sure you came by that money honestly, and they're going to call the police.
Not in the 60s, they're not.
No, they're not. They're going. Two men in very expensive suits are going to rush you into the back of a car, take you out to the desert, and discuss things with you.
Yes, and one of them's name's Bugsy, and you don't get to find out what the name of the other one is.
Nope.
Yeah, that scene was just weird. Like, I get the point, but. I also...
The way they did it was awkward.
Yeah, which was strange because the rest of the film didn't feel awkward in that way.
No.
But they also get to the revival tent and then, you know, oh, you're a sinner now. Apparently, the original ending, which was not... I don't believe it was filmed or it was filmed and cut out. The reason he's screaming is after he pulls his eyes out, he says, I can still see. Which, quite honestly... I wish they had left in, because that would have been really, even more creepy than it already had been. And I do give Corman credit for not freeze framing or giving you any more than like three flickers of view of Ray Milland without eyeballs in his head, because obviously that effect would not have held up at all.
No, it's like, wow, I have in my notes, that's the neatest eyeball extraction in the history of medicine.
Yeah.
Because... It's very clear. He's basically got, I've got eye-shaped green screens now.
Yeah, that's all well and good. There's ups and downs in this film. I don't know about you, but I think it's about time we decide whether those equal a good film, a bad film, or just more core man.
Yeah, okay.
The finish.
So, Max.
You.
You may have seen this before. You don't remember how you liked it. You said it was boring when you were a kid.
I thought it was dull when I was a kid.
What do you think now?
I think there's some really interesting ideas in it. I think a lot of the concept is cool. I like the idea that as his vision proceeds, as his abilities increase, it's not just like, I can see through walls or whatever. He can see through the fabric of reality. The idea is like he can see God.
That's what it's meant to be, yeah.
In the revival tent, they say he can see Satan, the devil, and sin.
Of course they do.
Yeah, because I'm like, good. Go on into the tent revival, because those people are notoriously rational, accepting, and welcoming.
Yeah. Mentally curious.
Yeah.
Well, then we get this really... I was sorry that they did this at the very end, but we get that whole science versus religion comparison here. It's just kind of slapdash, and then, you can hear whip, whip, whip.
Yeah, it's thrown in as almost an afterthought.
Which is too bad.
It is, because that would have been a much more interesting story. I think this is a hit and miss. I think there's some good parts. Overall, I don't know. I still found it kind of dull. And for a Corman film, kind of slow. is a lot of his, I gotta say, whatever else about him, Corman is decent at pacing, even if he does love his walking sequences. There's a lot of walking in Corman movies because, you know, he's got to pad out the film to 86 minutes.
Well, he's no James Wan, but then again, who is?
True.
So,
what about you? You'd never seen this. This was your first try.
Yep.
What was your takeaway?
I'm pretty sure that this is a movie that a still of Ray Milland with his black eyeballs has shown up in Famous Monsters of Filmland, Golden Probably. Turkey Awards, all that sort of thing. Like, I've seen that part before, and that's literally all I knew. I was pleasantly surprised. I thought, I actually like this better than I liked the Poe film that we watched, the Fall of the House of Usher. I thought Fall of the House of Usher was actually not as well-paced as this. And one of the reasons is that we get some occasional humor in this film. It's not huge. It's not big guffaws or laughs. Some of it is Ray Milland dancing. But it's enough to keep you going. And there wasn't a point where I was worried about falling asleep where... You know, in other films, it was even at 116 or an hour and 16 minutes, it was getting close to that. I think that there's some interesting ideas here. I think the parallels we both came up with for early Marvel Comics is really interesting because if it's not commenting on that part of pop culture, it means that the culture was in that mindset and he was just, you know, tapping into it. So good for him. I think in a way he's very restrained for Roger Corman. We don't see gore. This is a man who made a film called Buckets of Blood for, you know.
Yeah, true. Attack of the Crab People.
Yeah. And, of course, It Conquered the World, which starred a giant cucumber. I think that the special effects start off for their time being decent. Of course, then money runs out. I'm not sure what more they could have done at that time, but I think there was an attempt made. I think there's a lot of attempts made in here. Again, I detect a deftness even in its cheapness. I sense a man who knows the limitations, the boundaries of what he's trying to do, and is going right to the edge of all of them. Is the film experimental? Is it edgy? No, but he's not aiming for that. He's aiming for something that's meant to be, you know, public pop fodder, really. And he wants there to be something, I think, well done about it, and I think that comes through. I don't think this would interest a modern audience. I think you're right. It's going to feel slow. I have to say, though, most films of the time feel the same way.
Yeah, a lot of them do. Yeah, that's really a question. We're in the post-attention deficit disorder era.
Yeah.
You know, post-MTV, really.
And some of the choices just seem like, really? Like, we're gonna toss the eye doctor out the window. There's a witness right over here who will swear in court that it was an accident. No, we have to run? Okay.
Some of the dialogue also, never mind the I like men who look urgent, but the other...
I want a t-shirt with that on it now. For Pride Month.
I liked the one that Ray Milland says at one point that made me go, wait a sec. He says, I'd be able to see inside them as if they were windows. You don't see inside a window. Yeah. You see through a window. You're not looking at the window itself.
Yeah.
That was clumsy.
Yeah. I mean, there's some clumsiness in here. The whole I'm going to go to a carnival is a weird choice that I almost didn't accept. But then we get Don Rickles, and Don Rickles was amazing in this film. He really is. Creepy.
He's the high point.
He is, I think, the
best thing in it.
And, you know, they give him his moments where he gets to do his Rickles thing, but then those close-up of his face when he's just, like, the most sinister are actually kind of creepy. So, you know, good for
that.
And
when he's switching back and forth between his, like, healer persona, because we skipped over the section where he basically tries to sell Dr. X or Mr. Mentallo, as he keeps calling him, as a faith healer.
Right.
The way he's like, oh, so gentle with the customer, and then like, okay, get your ass out there.
I think, you know what, that I would say is the major problem with this film, is it touches on some really interesting ideas, and it doesn't really follow through because it thinks we're more interested in other stuff. And to be fair, the audience that's going for this kind of thing probably would be.
Yeah.
But yeah, the idea of if you've got this power and now you're making money off people's misery, there's a lot of conflict built into that. You know, on one hand, you got to eat and you have to keep away from the cops who think that you killed this eye doctor. On the other hand, you're looking at people and there's one woman that they don't say this, but it's implied. He tells her the pain's going to go away soon. The implication is it's because she's going to die.
Yeah. He says there's nothing I can do for her.
Yeah. So, you know, and then the whole idea of science versus religion there, you know, there could have been a real exploration of that, but that's not what this film's about. So yeah. I think I'm with you. I think I'm going to give it sort of a half. I think it's a good Corman effort. I really do. And I think there's interesting stuff in it, but I don't think it's going to hold up for today's audiences.
Yeah, I think it had a lot of potential that he just didn't explore. Maybe he didn't have the time, the ability, or the money, but don't know.
It was better than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, yeah. I'd go with that.
Yeah.
But certainly better than Little Shop.
Yeah, yes, a lot better. But you know what else is better? What's that? Poll question.
Oh, yes.
What non-actor, and by non-actor I mean they're not traditionally known for being an actor, what non-actor's performance in a motion picture pleasantly surprised you? Truman Capote, maybe? Or maybe more like Barbara Streisand, or what's his name who was in Star is Born with her?
Chris Christopherson.
People like that. People who aren't traditionally actors, you suddenly go, you know what? They weren't bad. How do you tell us about this? Well, you can email us directly at maxmikemovies.com. You can go to our website, maxmikemovies.com, leave a comment, give us an idea, talk about our series, tell us we stink, tell us we're amazing, whatever. Talk to Vince, talk to Cheese Boy. You can go to Facebook, where we are Max Mike Movies, leave a comment there, which is what most of you do. And again, same thing, let us know if stuff you'd like us to watch. Maybe we will do that. We still have episode 300 coming up. We have an idea. We'll probably go with it, but if y'all come up with something better, we'll do that, I promise.
Yep, yep.
And then lastly, if you like podcasts, and who doesn't, there's an app for you somewhere, and on that app is us, Max Mike Movies.
But waiting for you.
Waiting for you to join us. Mm-hmm. Join us next week, for example, when we continue Be Like the Core Man, but how will we continue that series, Max?
We're going to jump far into the future, into the distant future of 1980.
Ooh, UFO? We're going to watch UFO? I love that show.
No, we're not watching UFO, although there are UFOs in this.
There is.
But yes, this is probably one of Corman's biggest budget movies ever. Ooh. Went over $1 million.
What? He swore yes. he'd never do that.
He lied. And now technically... he is not credited as the director. He was the director. His fingerprints are all over it.
One of his releases, huh?
No, there's some other guy I've never heard of. But
could you imagine the film where Roger Corman himself wouldn't want to put his name on it?
I got to find out why his name isn't on it. I think he was trying to give... say what you will about the Corman, he did like to give other guys a chance. And he always believed in promoting other people.
He's a James Patterson of the movie world.
Yeah, pretty much. But, yes, this is a movie where we basically have John Boy in space in a flying uterus.
Now, wait a minute.
Battle Beyond the Stars.
Oh!
Yep.
That movie.
Yes, that cinematic object.
Hey, I gotta say, it's got a hell of a cast in it.
The cast is kind of staggering.
Yeah.
But we'll have to see how this one holds up.
Is the movie staggering, or is it us who'll be staggering? Only next week will tell.
Probably the best way to watch this is after drinking enough to make us stagger. But one way or another, we are going to watch it, we are going to talk about it, and you're going to hear about it, whether you like to or not.
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.